Welcome back to the Caught Red Podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jesse Light.
I'm Megan Light.
We are just two dog lovers talking about true crime, horror movies, and most likely our dogs too. And it's been a while since we've and we may have new listeners, I don't know, but we haven't really introduced our dogs and our cats in a while, so like we say, most likely our dogs too, but they don't really, they might not know who the heck they are. So we got Derby,
our oldest,
the OG, Megan's special favorite. She's got all the priorities.
Damn straight.
Yep. She rides in the front. I got a ride bitch.
She's 10.
She's 10. Then we got Mowgli, who just turned 6. Derby's a mini Australian Shepherd. Mowgli is a husky Australian Shepherd mix. He goes woo-woo a lot.
Yes, he sings us the song of his people every day.
He's got the prettiest eyes.
He got his daddy's coloring, which was the Aussie. He's a red merle, but he's shaped and has the attitude of his mama. Not me, but his actual fur mother.
Yes.
But me too, yes.
He likes to scratch his face because he gets allergies.
Poor buddy. Poor guy. Been living in a cone for 3 weeks. Maybe longer. I don't even know anymore.
And he likes to let us know when anyone's anywhere near our home.
Yeah, no one's breaking in this house.
No, we ain't scared.
No one's walking up our long-ass driveway to break in our house.
True. But Mowgli will fuck him up.
That's right.
Then we got Falco. We named him after Shane Falco from the Replacements movie. If you've never seen that.
It's Keanu Reeves. Yes. That's all you need to know. Gene Hackman.
He was the last of his litter. He's a special one.
Nobody wanted him, and now we know why. The warranty has run out, and we are stuck with him. He's 5.
He is a doof.
He is not bright, but he's the sweetest.
He's a blue merle. Yeah, he's special.
He's so special.
Then we got Ripley.
She's a bitch.
She's a chupacabra. We don't know what she is. We've done
2 DNA tests.
Yes, and it's just a bunch of nonsense. Little of everything.
She was actually brought home. Well, I brought her home because one of my best friends was like, she looks like an Aussie. Can you take her? And I was like, oh my God, yes. This girl has 2% or less Aussie in her.
She does look like an Aussie, though, but she's got an attitude of a Chihuahua.
She howls like a beagle.
Yes. Yeah.
She's just a bitch.
When it's 8 p.m. or later, she just turns into the devil.
She's a terror.
She'll jump up on the bed and I'll tell her to get down and she will cuss me out.
She will. And she's got these really pretty blue eyes, but one doesn't always look the direction it should. And we call her Forrest.
She's got the Forrest Whitaker eye. And then our cats, we've got Breeze, who is the oldest, and he just talks nonstop, drives me crazy.
It annoys the shit out of you.
Megan doesn't care. She loves it. So
I just talk to him all day. Oh, well, Ripley, she's maybe 3.5 or 4. We don't know how old she was when we got her. And now back to Breeze. He's
a thick boy.
4.
Thick boy.
He is big. He's 18 pounds.
If you haven't noticed, every fall, Megan has the itch. She has the itch to get a new pet, which I've told her no the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, Finnegan is next. She is a little brown tabby. Got her in the summertime, though. I found her in a bush. It was July. So her and Derby don't match the rest of the fall babies. And then we have Ozzy or Ozball Bones. He's
Bones from Bones, the show.
Yeah. He's 2. The liver 2. Pretty sure he's deaf. Or he has got the best selective hearing. I think he's deaf after Ripley attacked him.
Probably.
She probably shook something loose up there.
Something's loose.
But he's so sweet. I just wish he would come socialize more. He's very scared of everything, which could be because he can't hear shit.
He does have the sweetest meow.
Oh, I know.
And he's got the little cartoon eyes.
Yep. He's black and white.
But yeah, those are our critters.
I love our critters. Every day, almost for a while there, I would send him, like, look, this one needs a home. And I've tapered back a little bit. I've been doing pretty good.
But yeah, we like to hear about all y'all's critters as well. I mean, we are the podcast, PAWD. So yep. Y'all are our pod squad, so. Megan's got our case today. I'm excited to hear what she's got. So whenever you're ready, take it away.
All righty. Got a few sources that I'm going to list. We have Explore St. Louis. The Riverfront Times, I used quite a few articles by them. I went through some of the archives.
Is the Riverfront Times the ones you had to screenshot before they asked you to pay?
No.
No, it's no. Something else.
Did you listen to what I said?
When? You said archives, right?
I said archives, yeah. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I went through their archives. Then I used Major Case Squad, stlouis.org, which is like part of their police's website for investigations. I have KSDK Channel 5, casemine.com, and then this is the one that I was screenshotting a bunch. It's stlouistoday.com.
I also wanted to say, so we're recording December 12th, so it's getting to be Christmas time. So we're getting gifts rolling in. You know, Amazon's coming to the door every other day. Every day, really. But today, they drop off a gift. And, of course, Megan sees it before I do, so she knows what she's got. There's no surprises in this house anyways. We never wait till Christmas.
You were going to give it to me, like, tonight or tomorrow, anyhow.
Yeah, there was no hiding it. It was a big... big gift.
I had to help you carry it.
At first, you know, we were talking about it. I was like, you're not going to use it. It's just going to sit over there. It's a treadmill.
A walking pad.
Yeah, so like she can have a tall desk so she can stand and walk while she's working on her cases and stuff. And I'm like, first of all, if I tried it, I'd probably slip and hit my face on the slide back, but... I don't know if I'm good at multitasking like that, but.
Come work with me a few nights at the restaurant. You'll learn a few things.
Yeah. But I thought she'd like it, so we'll see.
Yeah. I told you, like, the days I don't feel like leaving the house to go work out, I can just walk.
Mm-hmm.
I might be eating as I walk, but I mean, I'll be walking.
Get you a desk with, like, a giant... bowl holder or cup holder. You can put your pretzels in the cup or you can put your...
That sounds amazing.
Salsa or something. I don't know.
Salsa? You want me to explode on the inside? What are you doing?
Anyways, go on.
Okay, back to the topic.
Where were we?
All right. For more than 30 years, St. Louis, Missouri was haunted by the deaths of four, maybe more, women. Their deaths were all attributed to someone named the Package Killer because of how their bodies were left waiting to be discovered.
I was like, it's not the UPS, like he's over here stealing their packages or something. Or
No, he's leaving them.
Waiting for him to open the door and coming in or something. No, it's not that kind of Package Killer.
It is not. And honestly, the name doesn't really match or make too much sense. And I'll tell you in just a second. But, like, you know.
Who gave him the name?
The media. And I was literally just about to say, like, the bad guy needs a name. So, of course, they're going to figure something out so they have something to call him. Because nobody knows who this guy is. They just know him as the Package Killer.
He have, like, a big package or something?
Oh, my God. Maybe. I don't know. Didn't see that picture. Let me tell you. Whoever was killing these women in 1990 and into 1991 was unknown. So like I said, they needed something to call him. O'Fallon, Missouri's Sergeant Detective Jody Weber would make it her mission to finally solve this cold case and give closure to the families of these women. It would take her 14 years. She was quoted saying, "It was amazing. I waited 14 years, not nearly as long as the families have waited, but I could not wait to confront him. The moment he walked through that door, I knew I had him. With the DNA, he couldn't deny anything."
So was this her, like, one case, like J.C. Ryder's case was Melissa Witt or what?
Almost. She joined the force in 2003, and then in 2008, she was given this case. Derby is very thirsty.
Gotcha.
And so she worked on it from that point. It was one of her main focuses.
Okay.
The women would be abducted from an area in St. Louis known as the South Side Stroll, a.k.a. Cherokee Street Stroll. It's a neighborhood that looks like nowadays is a place for tourists to explore, to get a chance to experience different cultures by going to art galleries and restaurants, antique shops. The area is host to the Cherokee Street Jazz Crawl every November, as well as other little festivals. The Explore St. Louis website actually says that it boasts a diverse assortment of independent businesses as well as active public spaces. And I found that kind of interesting because the way that it's described, back in the 90s, the Cherokee Street Stroll was home to various illegal activities like prostitution. And in my head, that's, oh, that's an independent business. Oh, they do that in public places. Like, to me, I was like, they're describing before and after.
True.
Now, some of the dates might be off a little between the different sources. You know, they kind of just differ slightly. So don't take my word for exact dates on these. But between March 1990 and February 1991... someone was taking advantage of these women, and no matter how and why they ended up living this kind of lifestyle, no one deserved to be raped and mutilated and murdered. Their bodies would end up being found close to highways leading to and from the St. Louis area. This man wanted them to be found, and he would end up gaining the name Package Killer because he would discard the bodies in some kind of container. He would wrap his victim in trash bags, and then he would place them into an assortment of containers, and they aren't consistent. It just seems like he used whatever he was near or what he had at the house. For example, one is placed in a trash can, another in a dumpster. One was in a homemade wooden box.
Package Killer is just a terrible name, then.
Yeah. Other victims were found in a barrel in a cardboard box. But the strangest, quote-unquote, package involved his first victim. On March 22nd, 1990, 18-year-old Robin Meehan was last seen by her friend Faye as she was getting into a man's car near the intersections of Texas Avenue and Cherokee Street. The women had a role. When one of them got into a car, she would make sure that the John would circle the block so the other woman could see who the driver was and get a better look at the car. Faye waited for this car to do the circle, but it never came around. She waited nearly 2 hours. When she was tired of sitting around, she decided to head back to the house that they were all staying in the Shaw neighborhood just a couple miles away. What is upsetting about Robin's disappearance is that it shouldn't have happened. Robin was trying to do the smarter thing, the safer way to do her job. She worked for a call service out of that house in the Shaw neighborhood, but on that night, the 22nd, it was slow. She, Faye, and Robin's brother Tom had gone through their supply of crack, and they were all in the need for a fix. They needed some quick money to prevent, you know, further withdrawal, thus leading Robin and Faye to work the stroll. Robin and her brother Tom got into crack cocaine when they were teenagers. This was during the time of the crack epidemic that was sweeping the nations in the 80s and the early 90s. If it wasn't sad enough that she was so young and on drugs, Robin was also a mother. In 1988, she was 16 and she gave birth to her first daughter, who she named Sandra after her mom. Baby Sandra was 3 months premature, but she was healthy. It wasn't long until Robin would get pregnant again, and this time her mother thought it would be best to put that baby up for adoption. And Robin agreed, and this is what blew my mind. Her second baby was born in March of 1990, so almost 2 weeks or so before Robin disappeared. Which makes me wonder, was she on drugs during that pregnancy? Because she was jonesing for a fix a couple weeks after her baby was born. Yeah. On March 26th, police arrived at Sandra's residence. She had been watching Robin's daughter while she, quote unquote, worked. And since Robin never came home, she still had the baby 4 days later. Sandra knew it wasn't going to be a good visit. The police were tiptoeing around, asking questions. She felt like they were stalling. It was finally Sandra who asked if her daughter was dead. An hour or so drive north of St. Louis is a town called Silix. It's a small town. As of today, there's less than 300 people.
People?
God damn.
What are you doing?
I don't know. It's a small town. As of today, there's less than 300 people. There was this driver who goes the same route day in, day out that noticed a pair of stacked mattresses along State Highway East. They caught his eye because he knew they hadn't been there on his previous venture. The driver decided to stop and see why someone would dump them.
Yeah, that's very random.
Well, to his shock, he found a body stuffed between the two of them. She would later be identified as Robin Meehan. And her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, whatever he was to her, was able to identify her from photographs that they took. Robin's autopsy found that her cause of death was strangulation. She had suffered a stab wound to her scalp, but the blade hadn't quite broken the skin. She had been beaten as well. Her body and her face were covered with contusions, some likely being from her trying to fight off her killer. But it appeared that some of the contusions happened after she died. To me, that just shows that he must have had a lot of rage. Maybe he was angry she fought back, and so he just kept beating her after she died. It seemed as though the gruesome discovery of Robin's body was just a single incident. No other cases in the St. Louis area remotely came close to hers. It was her choices and her lifestyle, maybe that was to blame. But 3 months later, on June 11th, another body was found. 40-year-old Donna Rittmeyer was wrapped in garbage bags and had been put in a trash bin from, I want to say it's Beiner Hardware or Beiner Hardware. I couldn't really find a pronunciation for it. The trash can was found near a city park, and that was in South St. Louis off of Gasconade Street. Donna was the mother of three, but she was struggling. She had last been seen in the St. Louis area, supposedly to meet someone. Like Robin, she had fallen on hard times, and the way that she was able to take care of her family was to be a prostitute. It was also how she was going to feed her addictions. Later, during the Package Killer's interviews, he will come out and say that he abducted Donna on June 3rd before murdering her in his home in Belridge.
What day was she found?
June 11th. October 4th, 1990, the police were alerted to a body found in a trash can on Page Avenue in Maryland Heights, which is just a suburb of North St. Louis. City workers were in the area maintaining the greenery, cleaning up the trash. A jogger passing by informed them of a weird smell in the area. And then not far off in the distance, they could see a trash can lying on the grass. They had picked up the can to put it in their truck. They smelled that same thing the jogger must have been talking about, and they looked in and found a decomposing female who looked to have strangulation marks. She was identified as a Jane Doe, and police would release a clay mask, little cast of her, to see if anyone would come forward to recognize her. All the police really had to go on was the trash can. The body was found in the same type as Donna. It was from the Biner Hardware store. The body had also been tied up by Connex electrical cable, but it was used by so many construction companies in the area. Anyone working a site or a stranger could have just taken some. But the catch was this cable was linked to Robin because Robin was also restrained by the same type of cable.
Anybody could have just stole some cable, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're thinking it's a serial killer now?
Yes. Now they have two trash cans from two different, and then two women tied up by the same type of ligature. It wouldn't be until March 1991 that this Jane Doe would be properly identified as Brenda Pruitt, a 27-year-old mother of one, by Janet Majors, who is a fingerprint examiner.
How? If there's a kid running around without a mother, that, surely somebody's going to come forward and say that's... I mean, really?
So
how long was it?
So Brenda Pruitt was reported as missing on May 9th, 1990. She was last seen on May 4th, 1990. Her body was found October 4th, 1990, and then they identified her March 91. It took that long.
So she was never really taking care of her kid, I guess.
Probably not.
Yeah. Foster system, at least, or like somebody, her mother was or something.
Yeah, at least somebody reported her missing, but they just didn't have a body to go with that report for months. Jumping ahead to February 17th, 1991, the O'Fallon Police Department received a strange call early that morning about 5 a.m. In Wentzville, Missouri, which is 40 minutes from St. Louis, a General Motors employee, the security guard, was heading to the GM plant, and he found this wooden box along the shoulder of I-70. Thinking it was a lost package, it fell off a truck. He put it in the back of his.
Without even looking at it?
No. He started to notice a smell, and it was coming from his gloves. He'd only touched one thing out of the ordinary that morning, that box. He went to inspect the box, and he saw that there was fluid leaking out of it. He decided to look inside, and it was probably the worst decision he ever made because inside was a decomposed body.
I should have looked at it before he put it in his truck.
Well, he did not. The body was identified through dental records. It was 21-year-old Sandra, or Sandy Sue, Little. After the fact, a doctor had come forward saying it could have been Sandy based on x-rays he'd taken on her a little bit before she was abducted. She had broken ribs and they had documentation of that. So I have two dates. One was reported in the February 22, 1991 edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The other is listed on the Major Case Squad site. So the article says that Sandy was reported missing September 4th, 1990. But the Major Case Squad said that she was reported missing October 10th, 1990. And it's weird because she's found February 17th, 91. So that's a big jump in dates, which I think it is the 4th because it's her boyfriend that reports her missing. September 4th, 1990 is before Brenda Pruitt's body was discovered, but already missing. So I think that makes more sense that he had one girl holding her or already had killed her and then went and got another one. And then eventually just dump them separately.
Or it just took him longer to find another body.
That too.
But if he's just leaving them out there where people can see, then probably not.
Sandy had a chaotic upbringing. Her mother, Carolyn, was mentally disabled. I read that she had the intelligence of maybe a preteen at the most. But it didn't stop her from having three kids, none of which she could raise herself. Carolyn would marry for stability, but that wouldn't last long. Sandy and her siblings were sent into the foster care system, and they were sent way up north to Alaska. St. Louis to Alaska. How crazy. The foster family opted to keep all the kids except for Sandy because she was too much for them. And at some point, I don't know if the siblings did get adopted or they chose to leave or what the case was, but an article said that Sandy and her siblings ended up back in St. Louis near Cherokee Street again. They would crash with their mother and whoever she was seeing at the time. And if Sandy wasn't already doing drugs, this is where it started. Her mother and her mom's quote-unquote friends were doing something daily at that house. And I would suspect crack, because that was the big thing during that time. It wasn't long until Sandy was taking herself out, becoming a prostitute. She had this habit to pay for. And her mom was also charging her rent to use the tiny guest room. By age 20, Sandy was pregnant and had given birth to a baby boy. 1990, she moved in with the baby's father and his mom, and things started to look up for her. She got a job at a restaurant. She was doing good, but it wasn't enough for her habit or her baby, so she would end up back out on the streets. Her then boyfriend, the baby's father, reported her missing on September 4th. I'm going with that one, not the case squads. After her body's discovery, more than 6 months later, all that remained were Sandy's bones. And then it looked like somewhat of whatever uniform she was wearing was kind of like pieced on her corpse a little bit, which meant she was likely taken after her last shift. No one knows for certain had she been walking home from work or had stopped somewhere along the way to get drugs, or maybe she got picked up by John. Or she was just abducted walking in general.
What's a John?
John is what they call the men they hook up with that pay them for sex. Johns.
Oh, okay.
Following the discovery of Sandy, there was a fear traveling around the South Side Stroll. The women out walking the streets needed to look out for themselves and each other. Diane Little, who is Sandy's aunt, said whoever killed Sandy killed some of those other women too. The St. Louis Dispatch listed their similarities in the paper. All the victims were white. All the victims were prostitutes from the South St. Louis area. All their bodies were left on the side of the road. And then also, oddly enough, all four of the women were mothers. It would seem that all four were working the streets, but when police started to dig more into each woman's life, Brenda Pruitt didn't fit. She had no record of prostitution. When the police were canvassing the stroll, the women working said the same thing, that they didn't even recognize her. Brenda had been arrested before, but for little petty crimes. What they did find out, though, was that Brenda had a friend that lived in a senior facility not far from Cherokee Street. So she could have just been walking, minding her own business, and taken. The man thinking she was a prostitute.
Yeah, I think all them having kids was just a coincidence.
It's a strange one.
Yeah.
There was one more woman who was possibly another victim of the same killer. Her name was Sandra Kane. She was 37, also known to be a prostitute. Unlike the others, her body had not been in a container or a bin of any kind. She was discovered on May 12th, 1991, near South Compton Avenue, which is not far from Cherokee Street. The police suspected that she had either been thrown off an overpass, thrown out of a car, or she had ran out on the highway and hit by a car. And this is the creepy part. Sandy Little was the last person to see Sandra alive. Sandy had warned her not to get into a station wagon. Police did all they could with the information they had gathered, but no results yielded. They had small samples of DNA from various items and the bodies, but in 1990 and 91, there wasn't much that could be done. The samples were preserved and stored, and there they sat in evidence for decades. In comes Sergeant Detective Jody Weber from the O'Fallon Police Department. Of all the unsolved cases involving women that I told you about, only one was under O'Fallon PD's jurisdiction. That was the body in the box, later identified as Sandy Little. Sergeant Detective Weber inherited the case in 2008, and she was relentless and she was determined. She went over case files who knows how many times. She read through the original investigator notes. She was locating and re-interviewing anybody she could. As she went through the evidence from the crime scene, she found that none of it was tested for DNA. For Sandy's case, there were 16 folders, and in some of them was information on two other women's cases, Robin and Brenda. Weber decided to pull the evidence for all three cases and sent those off for DNA testing. When results returned in 2009, nothing was found. She kept pushing. Years passed. Then a small fragment of DNA was found on a condom that was between the two mattresses that held Robin's body.
There was a condom in between the mattresses?
But
who's just carrying mattresses out there?
This
dude did.
Or like
driving around with mattresses in the back of your truck? Or like what's going on there? I don't know.
There wasn't enough of a sample to go through CODIS. So Weber visited the police's prior suspects for the cases, and none of their DNA matched that fragment. But as luck would have it, in April 2022, that fragment from the condom was run once again. And this time there was a match. DNA technology had just been making so many milestones, and then CODIS was able to snatch it up.
When did Jody start working this case?
2008.
Okay.
It came back to a man named Gary Muhlberg, someone who was never on the police's radar all those years. Funny enough, Gary was already sitting in prison. He had been found guilty of murdering a man in 93.
What did he murder the man for?
I will get to that. I will get to that.
Was he found in a mattress too?
No.
A box or something?
Oh, it was a box.
It was a box?
It was a box. In a really weird place.
Huh.
Gary Randall Muhlberg was not a good man. He never really was. He was kind of the bad apple for the family. It just took a little bit of time for it to show. It made me think about when you were sitting in the car before you went to Toyota to yell at him, and he said you had to let it marinate. And I think that's what this man was doing. His anger was like marinating in his body.
Now you got to tell everybody why I went in to yell at Toyota people.
Oh, gosh. I had a part fixed on my RAV4. They said it was ready. It wasn't ready. I had to wait like an hour and a half. I get the keys. I don't even leave the damn parking lot because when I hit the brakes, it was like da 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 da. And I was like, oh, great. So I circled back around the building and I pulled right back in and I walked up to the sales guy and I was like, you remember me? I just left. Hey. Pretty much they said they fixed the part, but never test drove it to see if they actually fixed the part. And they were going to send me on the road with it raining.
Dark out. That's why I was mad. I was like, what are y'all doing? Test drive it, make sure she's safe to drive this thing
right
back to work or home or wherever you're going. But no.
Nope.
I was letting it marinate in the parking lot. I was like, what exactly do I need to say to these people?
Do I yell? Do I not yell?
Yeah.
Anyhow.
I wasn't going to put him in a box, though.
No, not yet. Gary was born sometime in 1949. He was a native to the St. Louis area. He did come from a good home, surprisingly. He and his siblings were well cared for. His father, William, was a veteran, and he would move his family to Salina, Kansas, where he worked for an oil company. Gary graduated high school. After that, he and his older brother were drafted to fight in Vietnam. Gary never went to war, but his brother did, and he was killed in action. Gary married his first wife, which was his high school sweetheart, in 1970, and they had at least one child. You can decide if he was just waiting for an opportunity to strike, or maybe this, like I said, was just growing inside of him. Because 2 years later, 1972, Gary was arrested for robbing and raping an 18-year-old girl in Salina. For whatever reason, he was not convicted on the rape, but he was for the robbery. The courts decided that he just needed treatment, not go to prison. So he was sent to a veterans hospital in Topeka, Kansas. He would be released later that year because they thought he was no longer a threat to society. But oh, how wrong they were. Because the next year, not even that many months after he was released, Gary was arrested for assaulting a 14-year-old girl. He used a ruse. He asked if he could use the phone. She lets him inside, and then he bound and gagged her using a knife to, you know, produce fear in the poor child. And then I read that he put her in the bathroom, and he may have put her in the bathtub and turned the water on like he was going to try and drown her. While she's being held, Gary is going through the house. He's going to take, you know, anything that's worth value, but he saw headlights and got spooked. Somebody was coming home and he left. Once her parents arrived and found her, they reported to the police the events, and the girl was able to identify him through a book of mugshots. He was found guilty on that assault, and he would just be paroled a few years later.
What the heck? And then 40, 50 years later, he's gotten away with all of these crimes, so and far. Who knows how many more.
Right. We don't have any more out there. Following his release, he tried to go on the straight and narrow. He got remarried in 1980. His first wife divorced him in like 72 or 73 when he got arrested.
Oh, thank you. Good.
Right.
I'm surprised the next one married him.
Does she know his history? They had a couple of kids, but that, it just wasn't for him. He was bored of being good, and he tried to be a college student. That wasn't for him. He tried to do like menial, basic jobs like construction. Not for him. His life was just fizzling out. His marriage fizzled out. She divorced him and took the kids, but that was fine. He didn't really care too much about any of them, honestly. Gary was over trying to do manual labor for work to make some money. He thought selling drugs would be the best way to make ends meet.
He can't really get a decent job anywhere with his record.
Probably not. By the late 1980s, he had built a false wall in his home where he stored kilos of mainly marijuana. He started to dip his toes in the services of prostitutes about this time.
Like he was a pimp or?
Like he was getting ladies getting in his car and getting some sugar.
And selling drugs to him.
Probably, yeah. It's a vicious cycle. In the early 90s, he started buying and selling cars. He didn't do very well in that business. Most of the time, it was illegal what he did. Like, there were no titles, or he took just cash, or he had just stolen a car to flip it. Which brings us how he got to be in prison for murder in 93. February 8th, 1993, 57-year-old Kenneth Atchison was planning on buying a car from Gary. There were a couple of witnesses to this conversation. Kenneth was eating at a diner prior, talking to some folks there that knew of Gary. Kenneth informed them that he was going to go to Gary's home to buy it. Kenneth was going to trade his Chrysler LeBaron, and then he was going to give $5,000 in cash. I read $6,000 also for Gary's red Cadillac. Both of the witnesses offered to accompany Kenneth to the house, but he denied. Kenneth was worried about going on his own, but he had the money right in his pocket. He's ready to go. He decided everything would be fine. Once Kenneth exited that diner and headed to Belridge, it ended up being the last time anyone saw him alive. Similar to how he treated the women, Gary Muhlberg was not kind to Kenneth or his remains. After Gary lured Kenneth to his home, he murdered him, he stole the cash, and he kept both cars. Gary would end up going on the run, and when Kenneth never came back, he was reported missing 6 weeks later.
How is that?
6 weeks. That's so bad.
How does that happen? You got no loved ones that are like...
He had kids, but maybe they didn't live, or maybe he didn't have a relationship with them. The men from the diner told what they knew about Kenneth's last sighting and their conversation. And what they knew, plus everybody else in the diner, about Gary Muhlberg.
How did the detectives even find out about the diner if it was 6 weeks later and nobody... Like, that's just crazy.
I'm sure the men came forward.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of them going there. When the police arrived at the Muhlberg residence... They would end up finding Kenneth's body. The autopsy would later show that Kenneth was strangled, but before he died, he was tortured, stabbed, and shot. Again, like his other victims, Gary had put Kenneth in a makeshift coffin, aka a box. This coffin was found in the home's basement. The basement was really weird. It had several rooms made with thick concrete walls and a secret room that had a drywall panel acting as a door, and it ended up being a corridor that led from the basement to his driveway.
Gary's.
So it sounds like Gary had little torture chambers.
Sounds like the movie
Holding Cells.
Barbarian.
Ooh, yeah. The women he took were all held for different amounts of time, so he either kept them alive or dead down in that basement.
So it wouldn't surprise me if he had multiple women at one time.
Yep. After a short manhunt, Gary was caught towards the end of March 93 in Illinois. You didn't catch me. Okay. In Illinois, he admitted that he knew Kenneth and that he was in a box in his basement, but he never admitted to killing him. He had some story about getting into an argument with Kenneth and Chuck Nichols, who used to be Gary's boss. He said his boss was the one that killed Kenneth. And it might not have been that far-fetched of a story, only because there were rumors that Chuck Nichols, his boss, and his family were into drug trafficking. Nevertheless, Gary went to trial for the murder of Kenneth Atchison and was found guilty in September 1995. He was sentenced to life without parole. And there he sat for decades until Sergeant Detective Jody Weber finally solved those cold cases. She was quoted saying that Gary looked surprised to see us after 32 years.
I bet. He probably didn't know all that DNA stuff was out there.
Weber's first visit was simple, giving Gary the initial facts and that his DNA was found. He didn't say anything to object the information. On Weber's second visit, Gary Muhlberg admitted to the murder of Robin Meehan, Brenda Pruitt, and Sandy Little. He would end up making a deal with the prosecutors that he would plead guilty for these murders if they took the death penalty off the table. So Gary ended up agreeing to talk about the murders, giving full confessions. Gary Muhlberg and Sergeant Detective Weber sat for hours as he told her about his actions in the 90s, 90 through 91. In 2022, Gary was 73. So... recalling might not be his best, you know.
I was thinking feature. He was older than that. Mm-mm. God, he served in Vietnam War, everything.
He said that with each woman he abducted, he took them back to his home in Belridge. He would kill them there. He held some for months before disposing of their bodies. When asked why, he didn't know. He had a great childhood. The only terrible thing that happened was the death of his brother. A few days after their last meeting, Weber received a letter in the mail. It was from Gary, and he wrote that he didn't tell her everything. He told of two more murders, the first being Donna Rittmeyer, and the second was a woman who still remains unknown. He said he disposed of the remains of a young woman in a metal barrel and left her in a self-service car wash. Weber couldn't find a police report matching what Gary had written, but she did find the son of that car wash owner and spoke with him. And the son said that he remembered his father being upset that he had found a body at one of their locations in Pagedale, which is just another suburb of St. Louis, 20 minutes from Cherokee Street. Weber spoke to the officer that worked that area, and he too vaguely remembered a body being found, but there wasn't much else or nothing really happened after that. Sergeant Detective Weber is now working to find out who this woman was, going through as many files in storage as she needs. As of today, December 12th, 2023, Gary Muhlberg is still alive, but he is suffering from kidney failure, which is another reason they didn't need to put him to death. It's going to happen sooner or later. He also had a bad fall and is in a wheelchair. And I don't tell you that to show you sympathy towards this man. I tell you that because it's saying karma is a bitch and it's working its way back around to him.
It's like Samuel Little. He is in a wheelchair.
He's just going to remain at the correctional facility until the devil calls him home, which is fine by me. The women and man that Gary took from this world, they were well-loved and they were missed. The women may have made some poor choices, but to them, their dangerous lifestyle was their only choice. None of his victims deserved the suffering and pain that they endured. Every one of the victims had at least one child, some of them who were too young to even remember their mother. But now the families of Robin Meehan, Brenda Pruitt, Donna Rittmeyer, and Sandy Little can have closure knowing that the man that took their loved one was finally caught. And then cross your fingers that Sergeant Detective Jody Weber finds out who that fifth unknown female is. That way her family, too, can have closure.
So, talking to him, he never really said why he killed them?
No, he had no reason why he started killing. He didn't admit to anything. Because, you know, a lot of cases, they had shitty upbringings. They were abused. Their parents did drugs, whatever it was. He came from a good home. He was just a bad apple. Something in him clicked. Yeah. But it all started after he went into basic training, lost his brother, because he was married for 2 years to his first wife before he attacked an 18-year-old. So it's like, did something happen while he was away in training? Or, you know, like something just flipped off in his brain.
Hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, was he drug dealing and selling to them and they couldn't pay him or something? Or
maybe
was
so.
He...
I mean, we can never ask
just
those
looking
people.
For a prostitute? I don't know. Wild.
I just thought it was crazy that for 30 plus years he'd been sitting in jail.
Well, there's
and had she not taken over the case, who knows how long that DNA would have set in
so
evidence.
It was just a cold case sitting there for God what?
32 years?
Yeah.
Almost. When it was solved. I had read in one of her interviews, the detective's interviews, that when she joined in 2003, she was just excited to be a cop. And then in 2008, when she was going through the case files, she remembered Sandy Little from growing up in O'Fallon. Like, remember seeing her in the on the news and the newspapers and stuff. And so she really took it to heart and really, like, connected with her case to want to find out who killed her. So that started everything, was her connection back home to Sandy.
Well, good job, love.
Thanks.
As always, thank y'all for listening. We appreciate it. We will be back when we will be back.
Are we taking time off? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I think we're going to take some Christmas time off. We'll see.
Well, especially next week, we're doing my family's early. And so that's research typing time. It's fine. Maybe we'll pop in with something special.
Or we can like republish our Ronald G. Simmons episode.
It was
during Christmas.
I don't want to listen to it. That's one of our first ones. I do not want to listen to it.
That was episode
5?
Was it?
4 or 5, I think.
But it wasn't even a Christmas episode.
No,
but
I just found it. It was like
during
it.
December when he did what he did.
Yeah, it was Christmas time.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I still need to finish that book, so. Until next time, stay local, shop local,
murder local.